Yes, the video is tell you the thing that I was planning to speak on Monday, but we didn't have time. So this is about a code that Martin Kassar and I developed together. Martin was a postdoc in the Institute for Advanced Study, and he just now moved to the Beaumont Institute in Copenhagen, and we just keep working on this problem. And hopefully I will just finish it within half an hour, and then Joe and Elton will take over and talk about some more interesting about the just finishing the PhD. So okay, because this is an informal discussion, so I will present this in the unusual order. Instead of skipping all the introduction first, I will just describe the mathematical setup with all ideas. So I will present the problem, and then I will start to talk about the motivation and applications. And the hope is, because this is not a week for astrophysical turbulence, if you are bored about this part, then you can think about this problem. And after I finish, then I will ask for your suggestion. Maybe somebody can actually come up with a brilliant idea to solve this problem even better than what I'm doing now. Then I will show you what is the standard method, and the problem of the standard method, and then I will show you what Martin and I are doing now. Okay, so this is the problem. The idea is how do you do FFT for a triangular periodic system. So this is just your fundamental domain. It's periodic. It's going to be periodic, so I just you copy the box many, many times like that. So what I mean by triangular periodic is after a delta time, your system actually got shifted. So that is still strictly periodic along the y direction, but if you want to go to x direction, you need to shift a little bit. So if you write down the boundary condition, then it's actually like that. Like the y direction is just strictly periodic, you shift by the size of your Ly. But on the x direction, if you want to move to this box, you need to go back a little bit. And how big you go back, it actually depends on the velocity of these boxes. Okay? So this is the shearing periodic system. And we need to find a way how to use pseudo-spectral method on this system. And if you are bored about the astrophysical part, then you can think about it. Okay, so this is my slide for the astrophysical application. The shearing periodic system is really interesting because it's applicable to almost anything that carry angular momentum. So for the Earth, for the Sun, for the star, we know there's magnetic field, and that's because there's differential rotation in these objects. And that creates a dynamo. So Axel Brandenburg is the expert on this field, but he just left yesterday. Anyway, I hope you talk with him when he was here. And also last week, we hear a lot of talks about photopanspermia. So this is a simulation that I steal from Anders Johnson. So what you see here is they put a particle within a shearing box. And they, you know, see how this particle merge and form photopanels. So you can see the setup here is exactly what I described in the previous slide. So this is moving up, this is moving down. When things, you know, go through the boundary, they will come to the other side. The really convention depends on the time. Okay? Now for myself, I'm more interested in Blackmore equation. So that's the part that gives you a little bit more information. So this is a really simple introduction to the Blackmore equation. The most typical example is what we call the X-ray binary. So the idea is you have a binary star, they're orbiting around each other, but then it's unlikely that their mass is going to be the same. So the heavier star that's going to evolve faster, and say light, the biggest star, last one to the black hole, and the other star is happening that it evolves to a state, you become red, dry, and you can bake it. So one star becomes a black hole, the other star becomes bigger. So the material from the bigger star is going to stream toward the black hole. But because this system is orbiting around each other, it has angular momentum. So instead of falling directly onto the black hole, this material actually orbits around and forms accretion disk. But if you do a really, really simple estimate, then it turns out that this system is able to turn 10% of your rest energy into radiation. So this is the most efficient mechanism to to convert energy to radiation. It's actually an order of magnitude more efficient than fusion. And this is, so this can actually generate the most energetic object in the universe. And so really nice thing about it is because we are so close to the black hole, and when people use telescope to view timing of this system, they actually see oscillation at a frequency of kilohertz. So that frequency actually corresponds to the orbital period of the innermost stable orbit. So if we your physics right, and we can understand where this oscillation comes from, then we may be able to use some fundamental physics and scalar relativity. Okay, but now why do we care about turbulence in this system? The reason is these are all plasma. If you just put the molecular viscosity in, then you'll find the molecular viscosity is just too small to remove angular momentum. Still plasma because you're orbiting around there forever without giving you the energy. So in order for this system to work, we have to have some turbulence to give us the angular momentum transport. And just to give you a number, so for this rebound, the typical wave motion is 10 to the 12. So really, if you think about direct numerical simulation, the degrees of freedom is 10 to the 27. So you can definitely go to directly. So one approach is to do large energy simulation, but the other way is just go to going to a smaller subdomain of this and then study the sharing box. So now we can look at the local NHD equations. So this is my computational domain. It is the standard square. That's my black hole. You can actually see here. I actually draw something. It's black. Yeah. Okay, now you can see it's a black hole. That gives me my gravity. But now my equation is actually rotating, so I have a velocity. So this velocity here actually, so if I co-moving with all my material, then I remove this background velocity, but I still have this potential rotation. So instead of evolving the total velocity, you need to evolve the fluctuation with a shearing background. Okay? And also because this system is now co-rotating, so you also have an extra term here that describes the rotation. Okay? So this is the set of equations we are solving in the trillion box in order to study how turbulence got generated in the equation is.
What's big U?
What's that?
What's the ratio of big U?
So big U here is really the carrying velocity. So if the equation is rotating this way, then the U square over R will actually balance your gravity.
I just don't see big U in the equation.
But you don't need you there because you're co-moving.
So you've already subtracted it off.
So you already get it and transform away the mean velocity. But the differential rotation, we cannot subtract away. So that's this part.
And what boundary conditions do you have there?
So so this is moving here. So that's my x, that's my y. Mm-hmm. So in my y, just strictly periodic. But on the x, because of this differential rotation, then you have the sharing periodic boundary condition. Yeah, and I should also say that this is a discussion session, so please feel free to speak and ask questions. So a really nice thing about MHD is we can actually have the exact solution, yeah, even though the system is nonlinear. So if we assume that in the shearing box everything needs C dependency, then the logging term themselves actually cancel out. If you don't linearize the system, they just become linear. And now you can write down this dispersion relation on the equations I just showed you. And now you can solve all that. And then you'll find out the system is unstable for certain wavelength. There is a peak at the growth rate, which turns out to be this formula. And you can also calculate how unstable this system is. So now let me just show you a movie. So the color here denotes the y component of the magnitude, this direction. So actually, that's the dominant component of the magnetic field. So this is actually a pretty positive of the geology. So initially, I just put a constant BC and really small fluctuation to use this greenish thing. But as I told you, the system is unstable. And it, yeah, so the fluctuation actually grow. And then this is the so-called channel solution, because this is actually an exact solution to the MHD equation if you assume everything only depends on scale. And then this channel solution breakdown becomes turbulent. And then this kind of MHD turbulence giving us the angular and momentum transport in the equation disk, and then they power the black hole. Yeah, so let me just play this movie for a while so I can do that. So you can see here, this is the string periodic part, and that's the shearing periodic part. So I guess we don't have too many theories about turbulence. We only know the scaling law. But one really nice thing about the system is when we solve the linear the dispersion relation, you can actually solve for the eigenvector. And then using the eigenvector, you can predict what is the relation between your Maxwell stress and the Reynolds stress. Okay, so this is only a theory, and we probably with the solid line here. And then if you do the simulation, you actually find out the prediction from the linear theory actually give you pretty well agreement of your nonlinear system. So that's one thing. What I think.
Does that mean we're weakly turbulent here?
So the turbulence is actually strong, but I've actually we try to rise it back in here. So the other nice thing here is the instability depends on the shear. And if you don't have the correct direction of the shear, then your system is stable, and then you cannot create any stress. So what I plot in this graph is, this axis is the shear, so the positive direction is the static padding shear. So when you're close to the black hole, you're moving faster. When you're away from the black hole, you're moving slower. That's how we define the positive shear. If you do it the other way, then you're moving faster outside the black hole, but then the system is stable. Now, if you just look up the standard textbook, what people usually model accretion disk is they just assume the stress is linearly proportional to shear. So this dotted line is a theoretical model, the standard model. But now if you just think about MRI itself, then you can already tell there's no way this can be true. So there are two people, including Martin and I, Occhiofi and other people, they try to model this system, and then this system now is a prediction from this model. And then we again run a lot of simulation with different kind of shear, and that's what we find. So we are not trying to convince you that our model is the best, but at least I want to show you that the standard model is incorrect and you need to be fixed.
What's little r on the on the x-axis there, you have q equals one r. Is this just the radius?
Yeah, that's the radius. That's how we define the definition. So that is actually a general question that I want to ask the body and all the turbulence expert here. So what do people really think about instability in turbulence? Do you think it's just a chance here that drives the turbulence and you're through to the turbulence, they don't care about the instability anymore? Or do you think that the instability actually keep pumping your turbulence and give you some quality of the turbulence? So that's what people think here. Yeah. I guess people are still pretty sleepy. But I guess based on the plot that I just showed you, it seems, at least for the accretion disk, it seems the instability has something to do with the turbulence itself. It seems to just keep pumping. These are just different technical details about the MRI.
But wouldn't the instability
like turbulence provide another instability, so now you have one instability, and I mean, I don't know.
So okay, so there are more details there. So the MRI itself gives you the channel solution. So the channel solution will just flow forever. So in order for the channel solution to break down, you need something called polycyclic instability. So it's a secondary instability on top of why just so your people actually say that the saturation level seems to, you know, because of, you know, the secondary instability. But for some reason, when we do the medical study, we still see the signature of the primary instability. And I guess we just don't fully understand that.
I think it's probably a combination of both. That I mean, you need instability to get going, but then nonlinearity transfers that energy to other modes that would normally be stable. That's the usual picture. So not only do you get a cascade down to small scales, you can also you can have a kind of a transverse cascade. You can have if your instability is only in a certain direction, a certain eigendirection, then like maybe in one quadrant or something, that can happen. Only one quadrant of your wave number space is where you have instability. In the non-linear, you can couple to other directions.
Well, but
it can give you, it can make anisotropic driving more isotropic. I mean, generally, that's what the non-linearity tries to do, is to isotropize.
Yeah, that's what I always think about.
Yeah. So I think probably a combination of both.
Yeah.
It's not just to get things going, but it's the driving term for stable modes.
Okay, so now I will tell you actually the pseudospectral part. So how we actually simulate the movie that I show you. So this is the standard, I can actually know how to read this thing, so for gallows. So this is the standard method. The idea there is you do a remapping once for a while. So this part is the physical domain, so that's my fundamental domain. At some time, it was looked like that. And in the future, we just shift it in the other direction. So the idea there is you actually share your coordinates. So at this time, your x direction, your grid is actually like that. And then you just tilt your grid as time is moving. And when you do that, you're actually tilting your spectral space as well. Okay? But once in a while, you can actually find out you can pick one-to-one corresponding to the mode. So you just remap the mode and then you throw away this extra information. So this is a method proposed as early as the 77, and people just keep using it, and I guess the latest people using it is Maxwell and this group. So it's actually a working method, so people have proved it's working. And when your turbulence is drawn, the error you fall away here is just small, so you don't really care about that. But when your turbulence is weak, and you plot the energy, you can actually see the truncation and you do the remapping. So every time you do the remapping, you still drop in your energy, and then things start to smooth, and then you drop again. So that's the minimum disadvantage of this method. And of course, if you want to do your mathematics, then the proof theory in your Galerkin truncation thing, then you find that you cannot do that anymore because now you're doing this the truncation once a while. So so I ask people to think about how to solve this system. So can I get any suggestions?
What you could do is just if you just deal with the I mean, sometimes in simulation, especially if you're doing phase shift and de-aliasing, you only have a circle of modes left anyways. So if you only have a circle of mode left anyways, then you rearrange the things on the air. So if you did, if you fully de-aliased the entire field so that you had all those modes, then you just killed the corner modes, then when you shifted, you would just be shifting and remapping zeros, like your energy carrying modes might not be killed by that. You don't know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. So you're saying that you truncate enough modes so that so that when you do the
just keep hexagon or something
with your field, change your magnitude. So yeah, that's actually, you know, one good way to do that. But of course the problem there is now you're throwing more holes away. So it's your less efficient in terms of physics, that is better.
Yeah, but actually I mean like I was doing this with our simulations, is it because I mean you do lose some of the modes, like all these corner modes are gone.
Yes.
But those corner modes also have the highest frequency. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones which influence your time step the most. Mm-hmm. So while you get like a little bit of information, it really like, I mean, it was actually 20% faster removing those modes. And you can still basically reach the same Reynolds number because you have the same amount of dissipation.
So you're saying that the communication to your highest frequency is actually not that important?
Well, I mean, it is important. But I mean, you don't have all the highest frequency, right? You, like, you don't have, like circle, like, okay, so you look at your corner, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, root 2 times half your grid is the radius you achieve. Mm-hmm. But you don't have all those modes, right? So you don't get a lot of dissipation, because you only have 4 points at that maximum frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're willing to give up those 4 points of those maximum frequency, then maybe you just use a bigger box size, but circular. I mean, you waste a little bit of computation time de-aliasing modes at the corners, but then you end not using them, but you get something back by having larger time steps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think I agree with you. So in that sense, like, you maybe it turns out that your method, the efficiency will be pretty good because of the time stepping.
Yeah.
But okay, so anyway, I'm going to describe what we are doing, and then you will tell me which method is better. So now the idea is really simple. So again, so this is my fundamental domain. And once in a while, you get a shear, so you become like that. But now if you expand your domain big enough, then you will finally become strictly periodic again. Okay? And now you can do FFT of it. So the core idea is really as simple as this. You just expand your domain, so things become strictly periodic, and then you know how to do FFT. Now you may this really seems like a dumb idea because you need to FFT in a really much bigger domain, depending on the time.
So but is your shear rational?
Yeah, actually it doesn't need to be, but
isn't that an issue?
So I actually have that in my conclusions, like.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But now if you do that and you just count the degrees of freedom, you actually know that although you are transforming a bigger domain, there must be a lot of zero in your Fourier space. You just cannot create information from nothing. So this is a really simple derivation. So that's the sharing periodic boundary condition, except now I'm putting my T as QLT, so you're just rational thing. And then now I can transform this. You just Fourier transforming both x and y direction, and you get this extra factor. And now you substitute the definition of your case and your time. And then you find out you have this condition. So your Fourier coefficient is only non-zero when this is satisfied. So and you actually see this anti here. So this condition actually kills your redundancy. It's saying that if you double your box, then when you evaluate the coefficient, you actually find out half of them will be zero. If you triple your box, then two-thirds of them are going to be zero. Okay. So this is only a mathematical proof, but in terms of algorithm, it's actually easier than that because you just Fourier transform in your y direction. You do a phase shift in terms of each mode. So you're doing a shifting in your Fourier space, and then you do your x direction Fourier transform. And then you reinterpret what is the wave number for each grid. Okay, so that's the algorithm. And it is this pretty much the same computational cost as the original strictly periodic one. So
so you don't really solve it in two boxes like you showed.
No,
originally
you don't need to.
Title of the plane or something. And
you don't need to.
You don't need to do that. You just have to shift the next space.
Yeah, exactly. So I do want to mention that the algorithm I just tell you, it turns out it's mathematically identical to two other algorithms people proposed. So one is by this group, the other is by this. So both of them appear in 2007. So both earlier than my idea. But I guess our derivation is actually more general because it actually unifies these two papers. And you just tell you, it gives you a way to derive theory and things like that. So I guess my time is almost up. Let's see. This is okay. I will still tell show you this. So the idea I present to you can actually allow you to do some pretty crazy thing. So when I was undergrad, I actually do a project trying to solve some PDE on this kind of cells. So if you want to use a Fourier transform for that, you don't really know how to do that because this string periodic boundary condition. But now using the approach that I told you, I can pick out this fundamental domain. So everything is streaming periodic in the domain, but you can just, this is the same as this, this is the same as this. This is just like a sharing box. And now I can expand my domain. So now this domain is double in size and it's redundant. But I can just apply the theory. I just tell you to compute the Fourier mode here without any extra work. So I actually asked around and asked people, does it make sense to do turbulence in this kind of cell? Because it's more isotropic if you think about in Fourier space. And people say it doesn't really involve the effort. So if people here, you tell me it's actually an interesting problem, then I may work on it. Okay, so that's my conclusion. I guess we actually find out how to derive this so-called remapping free FFT. We are not the first people to propose this algorithm, but I do think our derivation actually unifies what people have been done. And this is kind of the rational thing that John has mentioned. So for any time, you can actually find a small enough number. So you're shifting your time a little bit, things become irrational and you can apply your own method. So we don't really worry about the irrational thing. It's just the completeness axiom. There are many, many open problems in the sharing system and they have a lot of application in astrophysics. And Martin and I are still working on the code paper, but hopefully we will release it soon and then you can just download the code and use it. And this is all I want to say. So, John, do you want to come?
Sure. So, about this rational thing. So, if you have an irrational shear, you just adjust your time a tiny bit.
So,
and make it rational. Basically.
So when you reinterpret the wave number, you can actually do it irrationally.
Yeah.
So, I guess in the real sense, when you actually program, you don't care. Mm-hmm. But if some picky mathematician come up, then I would say this is the reason I don't care about it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're on a computer, then you're guaranteed
a rational
number.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have a
irrational number, it's a question of low denominators, right? That's really the issue.
Mm-hmm. But you don't care because you don't need to really transform such a big box.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think the problem of working in other domains is very interesting and may have many applications. I am going to try to set the stage here for work that Malcolm is doing in his PhD thesis at the University of Alberta. So he'll speak next. I just want to tell some of the history behind what he's doing and why he's doing it. So it didn't start out as a pseudo-spectral method. It started out in spectral space, and one of the things I've been doing while I'm here is realizing how to do this mode reduction technique that I'm going to tell you about in a pseudo-spectral context, so it'll be much more efficient. Okay, let's see if we can get this up and running. And I'm not sure that the full screen is going to work here, but we can manage. I didn't have time to get my screen resolution adjusted, so yeah, I think we'll just have to do it like this. Is that readable? Is that okay? Yeah, it's okay, because it's a little bit grainy because it's not full screen. But okay, this technique is called the spectral reduction. This is old work. This is an old slide of mine. I gave up on this. This work is over 10 years old. It was published in PRL, and it was done in collaboration with Brad Shadwick and Phil Morrison. And it's an attempt to develop a reduced model for turbulence in the wave number domain by keeping not all of your dissipation modes, because that's where we spend 99% of our computer time in the simulation. And why are we wasting all this computer time in the dissipation region? Often the only reason we're modeling that is we're trying to prevent the energy from building up on the scales that we're physically interested in. Okay, so in other words, we need a subgrid model, and to go to high resolution, we'd like to be able to take the energy out at the grid scale in a reasonable way, and one such candidate for subgrid model is spectral reduction. Okay, it's more general than that, but that's how we're going to try to use it today in Malcolm's work. I'm first going to tell you about the more general setting. So the idea is to start off, I'm going to formulate everything for the 2D incompressible vorticity equation here. And so here it is here. This is the molecular viscosity term. I just call that nu k for convenience. And it can be any operator you want, any linear operator. And then we have the nonlinear term here. And I've written this in Fourier space in a way that emphasizes the symmetries of the nonlinearity. And this is not the Levi-Civita symbol, but it has the same properties, that it's anti-symmetric under the permutation of any two indices. So that's why I use that suggestive notation. So this is just the U dot grad U term. We're working with vorticity, so there's no pressure term appearing explicitly. Okay, so this, the nice thing about this is it conserves energy and it conserves entropy. And that follows from these symmetries that epsilon over k squared q squared, that's anti-symmetric when you change k to q. And so that gives us the energy symmetry. And likewise, epsilon over k over q squared, that's anti-symmetric in k going to p. And those are the symmetries underlying these two conservation laws. They're going to be very important when we develop our reduced models. We're really doing a coarse graining. And we're doing this coarse graining in such a way as to still conserve something like energy and something like entropy. There's a coarse grain energy and entropy, which you have to define. But the main thing is that there are two quadratic integrals like that, which are conserved by the nonlinear term. So the way we're going to do it is we're going to define new variables in wave number space, which are coarse grain bin averaged vorticity. So we're going to superimpose a grid onto wave number space. We'll use capital indices to refer to the coarse-grained variables, and lowercase indices like little k and little omega to refer to the fine scale information. So here's the definition for how I'm doing the average. I'm just going to take all the vorticities in a bin. So a bin is just some contiguous, it's a connected set of modes that I'm going to collect together, perhaps in the dissipation range. These will be quite large. And in the regions that I'm more interested in, the physically large scales, the forcing scale, the inertial range, maybe I won't have such large bins. So it's actually quite arbitrary how you choose these bins. And then we can immediately write down an evolution equation for the coarse grain quantity. And of course, it involves fine scale information, things that we're not planning to actually compute exactly. This is still the exact equation. And here I've got an integral over, from the original equation, I had a convolution here. I have an integral over p and q. This delta function makes it a convolution. By the way, I've written things in a nice symmetric form here. I didn't really mention that. It's maybe not the usual way of doing it, but it's more symmetrical. You just change p to minus p and use the Hermitian condition, the fact that omega is really the Fourier transform of a real field. So anyway, I've taken that integral over p and q, and then I've averaged it by bin averaging to get omega k. I've now got an average over k, p, and q, an integral. And so I've defined this symmetric averaging operator here like this. That's what this is, as opposed to this one-dimensional integral here. And the trouble is we're not going to compute this fine scale information, so we have to somehow close this equation. It's not a statistical closure, but it's kind of a wave number closure, if you like. And we can do a very crude thing. When I first, the idea first came up, I thought this was a terrible idea. But it turns out to be, there's a reason why it turns out to be much better than one might expect. Suppose we just approximate this fluctuating quantity by its mean. And, you know, it's the crudest thing you could possibly do. This is the closure this is the equation you'd get. It's nothing to do with the Navier-Stokes equation anymore. But you can consider it an auxiliary equation and study it in its own right and look at moments of it and ask, well, how close are the moments of this to the original equation? And for that matter, what about energy conservation? Well, immediately you find that although entropy is conserved, energy is not. And so we'll have to do something about that. It was actually not a very good suggestion what I wrote down there. I just wanted to show you the typical thing I might do. If you're looking at turbulence, even an isotropic turbulence, and each realization isn't isotropic, so you might want to have some anisotropic variation around here. But you can kind of think of this as an anisotropic shell model, except the coupling coefficients between these various bins, we're going to compute. That's what that term was back here. This is the coupling coefficient. And in shell models, they're just written down. They're just prescribed. They're toy models. They're not really derived systematically from the Navier-Stokes equation. What we're going to do is try to derive those coupling coefficients from the Navier-Stokes equation. And my first attempt failed miserably because it didn't even conserve energy. Okay, so basically what I want to do is those coupling terms are a counting of how many modes in this P bin interact with modes in the Q bin to affect modes that are in the K bin. It's really just a counting of interactions. And you don't have to use that geometry. You can use any geometry you like. There's the energy and there's the entropy. Entropy is still conserved because that's got the right symmetry. When you average this thing and change variables, you can change little k and little p, in addition to changing big K and big P, you see that you actually do have the right anti-symmetry. That's easy to show. But energy conservation has been lost because that mixes the fine scale and coarse scale information. Okay, so you can't pull these, you can't interchange these two things, K and Q. So that's a big problem. However, there's an easy fix. Simply pull out this fine scale thing, modify this coefficient. Don't use that coefficient, that was the wrong one to use. Use this one. If you use this coefficient instead of this thing, then when you divide by 1 over k squared, you got the right anti-symmetry again, just what you need to get energy conserved. So that little fix corrects some of the terrible errors that I made in this crude approximation. So here's a new equation. And the question is, what good is it? It's certainly not the Navier-Stokes equation. But we call it spectral reduction, or the spectrally reduced Navier-Stokes equation. It conserves energy and entropy. One of the nice things about it, if you make the bins really small, until so small that there's either 0 or 1 modes in a bin, then it's exact. So unlike statistical closures, we actually have a control parameter here that we can modify to get a better answer. So that's a really nice feature of this. It also has the same general structure and symmetries as the original equation. And in this sense, you can think of it as a remapping of the original equation, and even maybe try to look for fixed points of some renormalization. So that's an interesting subject in its own right. Another property is that this obeys the Liouville theorem, and that suggests if the dynamics of this is mixing, that in the inviscid limit you're going to get the expected statistical mechanical equipartition solutions. However, there's a problem, and I'll come back to that in a minute. I just wanted to mention that. When the bins are large, we know that the instantaneous dynamics is going to be quite different than Navier-Stokes. I mean, we made such a terrible approximation. The way we got this is we approximate fluctuating quantities by their mean. However, nevertheless, once you take moments, the situation changes a little bit. So if I take the original entropy equation and obtained by multiplying my vorticity equation by omega k complex conjugate. I use stars here for complex conjugate. So I multiply by omega k star, and then I bin the result, because what I want to do is take the exact result from a full simulation where I keep all the fine scale stuff. I want to bin it, and I want to compare that to my bin prediction for the moments, not for the original fluctuating quantity, but at the level of moments. So I've taken the second moment, I've binned, and now I'm going to time average, or do some kind of averaging. It could be an ensemble average too. And the only things that depend, only random things, are things like this. And you see you've got a second moment there and a third order moment here. And the interesting thing about this second moment and this third moment is that we expect them to be smooth functions of Kp and Q. This one is smooth on as long as you stay on this four-dimensional surface, or surface in four dimensions. It's defined by the triad. Actually, no, it is a four-dimensional surface. It has, because we're working in 2D here, so there's six dimensions, but it's a four-dimensional surface embedded in six dimensions. And on, if you stay on that surface, then this is a smooth quantity. We expect these things to be smooth. The very idea that there's an energy spectrum says that the moments should be smooth functions of wave number, okay? Some power law or something, okay? We don't expect it to be fluctuating wildly once you've time averaged or ensemble averaged. And then I use the mean value theorem to say that even though the vorticity value, the fine scale vorticities in a bin aren't all equal to their mean, or even you take their moments. I'm interested in their moments of the vorticity. They're not going to be exactly equal to the mean, but there is some value in the bin which is equal to the equal where the mean it equals the mean. What I mean is the reason for this is it's from the mean value theorem for integrals. There is some the vorticity, if you think of this as a continuum index now and not a discrete index, the index on omega, if you go to the continuum limit where we don't start with a with discrete modes, but we actually start with we work in an infinite box, so we have a Fourier integral transform, and then this index can vary continuously, then in that case the vorticity takes on its bin average value somewhere in the bin. That's the mean value theorem for integrals. And so the only question is how much in a bin can k vary from this wave, the special wave number c? And if the bin isn't too big, it won't vary very much. So it's a question of how good an approximation you want here. But I already said that in any case, we don't expect this quantity to vary discontinuously over a bin. We expect the variation to be quite slow. We expect this to be a smooth function. Although the fluctuating thing is not smooth, once you take moments it is. So that's the upshot. And so, therefore, when you want to calculate this thing here, you could calculate it when you take moments. This is actually a smooth quantity. And this was done already by Leith and Creighton when they implemented statistical closures back in 1971, which is where the motivation for all this work came from. But the trouble there, or the difference there, is that those quantities that Leith and Creighton were binning, they had an isotropic version of the binning I'm talking about here. Those quantities they were dealing with were statistical correlation functions and response functions, things that are smooth, and were able to take them out. But here, we weren't able to take them out until we took moments like this. So now I can justify the very crude approximation I did before at the level of moments. I can take this out, evaluate it at the bin average values, Kp and Q, and when I do that, this is what I get. So this is not the same equation as the exact bin average entropy equation, but it's close. So I made a small change to my equation, and the question is, how does that affect the solutions? That's another question. We all know that if you make a from singular perturbation theory, if you perturb a differential equation, the solution may be drastically different. I mean, think of Euler and Navier-Stokes, for example. So we don't really know that this is that the solutions of this are the same. We're going to need to validate this numerically. But what I want to point out about this is that this, if you make one more little change and pull that q squared out like I did before, that should make a small correction as well. That's also a controllable approximation by not making your bins too big. This wave number q is also a smooth quantity, so I can bring it out. And so these two are basically the same. And what this is precisely the time average of the spectral reduction equation. So at the level of moments, we see the equations are the same. Now the real question is, do they have similar solutions? How are we going to solve this equation? We're not going to do a closure on this. We're actually going to do a direct numerical simulation on omega itself and take the moments. Okay. So this is a way of trying to circumvent the closure problem. And it's something, an idea that came, it's about 15 years old. And it looked really good. We did some tests on it. Some of the initial tests looked quite promising. I won't spend too much time on that, but there was a nice agreement with a full simulation and with a closure theory. The closure theory wasn't quite as good. It wasn't one that's expected to be very good. Anyway, this is a realizable test field model. It's a realizable version of Kraken's test field model that's realizable even in the presence of waves. It turns out that was a big surprise, that when you add wave effects like the drift waves or Rossby waves to the 2D Navier-Stokes equation, you lose realizability. This was looking at the 10th order structure function, quite good agreement there too. It also has a spectral reduction also has a Hamiltonian, it doesn't have a Hamiltonian formulation, it has alluvial theorem. This is the Hamiltonian formulation for the underlying equations. And I won't spend too much time on this, but there is a alluvial theorem. This is the alluvial theorem for the underlying equations, and this is the alluvial theorem for spectral reduction. It looks very similar and works in an analogous fashion. Everything goes through nicely. So that's why one expects to get an equipartition. And one does. Except, when I talk about equipartition, I mean turn off the forcing, turn off the dissipation, and let the nonlinearity relax and see what spectrum you get. So in 2D, there's a well-known spectrum that you should get. You should get an equipartition, not of energy or not of entropy, but it's some linear combination of energy and entropy. Okay? And that's what you should be getting. And unfortunately, there's this extra factor, delta K, here. So if delta K is the area of a bin, that's how I defined it. If all the bins have the same area, then in fact, this is the correct equipartition spectrum. These alpha and beta, the alpha and beta are just Lagrange multipliers associated with these two invariants. However, this is the correct equipartition only for uniform bins. What we've got is this bin system has lost memory of the fact that it came from modes. The bins don't know how many modes there are inside of them. The bins evolve according to an ODE. It conserves energy, it conserves entropy, and so it relaxes to an equipartition of bin energies. If the bins have different sizes, that isn't what you want, because you want it an equipartition. Like, let's look at the special case where beta is zero. That's one Lagrange multiplier. You can choose that depending on how you initialize things. So we could choose it where alpha is the only Lagrange multiplier, and then in fact what we're getting is an equipartition of energy. It's easier for me to talk about that case. So the exact system should relax to an equipartition of modal energies. If the bins have different sizes, that isn't the same as an equipartition of bin energies. And so this thing gives you the wrong result, because it tries to give you an equipartition of bin energies. There is a way to fix this up, and it requires rescaling time in a weird way, in a mode-dependent way. So each mode gets a different rescaling of time. That will certainly change your path to the steady state, but it will not change your steady state equation, because all I'm doing is rescaling the time derivative in a way that depends on which bin I'm in. By doing that, you can give these big bins a sense of how large they are, how many modes they have. You're adding some sense of mass into the system. You're basically saying big bins should relax faster to equipartition because they have more exchanges with the background thermodynamic bath that's outside of them that they're interacting with. So they have more microscopic interactions, and so we expect them to reach equipartition earlier, large bins. And that's what this factor physically accounts for. And then we get the correct equipartition spectrum, which we're looking for. So this is what one, in terms of the vorticity, this is what it looks like. Well, that's all nice. But it turns out there's a bit of a problem. I mean, I've actually implemented here. It works just fine. The only thing is, it's extremely slow. This factor, what I've done is I've taken my small scales and I've made them go even faster. They're already, the Navier-Stokes equation is already extremely stiff. There's a huge range of time scales, and the small scales are the ones that set your time step, and they are evolving very fast, and so that sets your time step. Your large scales take a long time to evolve, and that tells you how many time steps you're going to need, and it tells how long your simulation is going to be. Okay, and the ratio of these two tells you how many time steps you're going to need. So this is the last thing we want to do. What we've done is we've taken these small scales and make them evolve even faster. Like I'm talking in practical situation, I'm talking millions of times or billions of times faster than before. So I've taken a hopelessly stiff problem and made it even worse. In a way, what I've done is I've taken all the problems in space. I've taken the huge separation of scales that we have in space, and I've reduced the number of spatial scales, sure, but I've put all this problem now into time. So the problem creeps up somewhere else. And so this is a huge problem. It's what caused me to give things up. I spent about a year on this problem, and I didn't come up with a satisfactory solution. There may be something you can do on average here, but there seems to be no exact solution to this problem. Here's the problem. If you're given an efficient numerical method for solving a system of equations like that, can you give me now an efficient numerical method to solve this equation, which is almost the same, except I've multiplied the right-hand side, the source, by a constant real diagonal matrix? And this is the problem I haven't been able to solve. The usual method for stiff systems do not work, because in this case, the eigenvalues of the Jacobian of the right-hand side are close to the imaginary axes. And the traditional methods involve the eigenvalues having strongly damped negative real parts. So there's a lack of a method for this, and I think it's simply asking for something. I don't think it's possible, but there may be possible to do something on average, and that's still an open question. But that's not what we're going to tell you about today. Now I want to tell you about the new work and where Malcolm's work comes in. My conclusion from all this is that spec reduction does not work unless you have uniform bins. And for many years I discounted it in that case because I thought it's of no use. If the bins are uniform, then we are going to lose resolution at all scales, at all wave numbers. Okay, we're going to have to bin the same for large scales, the low k's and the high k's as well. And my whole point was to use very few modes in the dissipation range. I'm not going to be able to do that. So we're going to have to live with that somehow. And let's tell people, maybe I suggested years ago, maybe there is some use to this still, because if I have a uniform bin, this is not the same thing as just working in a smaller box. Okay, so if you take a traditional DNS and use a smaller box, you're really increasing the mode spacing, K0. Right? By making the box small, you're making your mode spacing bigger. Okay. And by doing that, you are so I guess what I'm saying is, suppose you have a full simulation, what you do is you omit all of the odd indexed modes. You simply delete them from your system. It'll still conserve energy and entropy, but you only use the even modes. You've done some kind of decimation on the spectrum. And so you've changed K0 from 1 to 2, effectively. What you're doing there is you're omitting all kinds of interactions, all kinds of ways for the system to dissipate energy through the odd modes. That's suddenly gone. And you're not going to get the same dynamics. What I want to do is somehow not just delete modes. There have been attempts. Detlef-Lewis and Siegfried Grossman have tried to do this. They published some work. There's other work too, and their work was called reduced wave vector set method for discarding modes at the particularly at the small scales. They discarded modes, and they did not try to account for the effect of the depleted modes. What we're trying to do in spec reduction is to say, all right, we're going to discard some modes, but we're going to not just throw them out, we're going to try to account for the deleted modes by renormalizing the nonlinearity. Okay. There have been other methods. Creighton tried to do something too. He tried to model the deleted modes by renormalizing the forcing, and Zhenxu Shi tried to model the nonlinear modes by renormalizing the linear term, the dissipation term. Here we're trying to renormalize, account for the missing modes by modifying the nonlinearity. And I just wanted to show you a result of a pseudo spectral run, this red one here, compared to a full simulation, a full DNS. And here we've kept only 1/9 of the modes in spectral reduction, so it's a 9 times reduction, and we get pretty good agreement. This green curve, in contrast, is what happens if you simply delete modes and don't account for them, if you don't renormalize them. In fact, all we did here is we changed K0, the minimum wave number spacing, from 1 to 3 in each direction. So we simply deleted, we kept only 1/9 the modes, and you get a completely different result in this forced dissipative run. We forced around here, and we dissipated. We forced at wave number 4, which is right here, and we used just molecular viscosity here, and we had a long wavelength. We had a friction actually operating across the whole scale as well to take out energy. The friction is most effective here, and it prevents energy from piling up, bouncing off the lowest mode and piling up here. So this is a 2D simulation. So we have this inverse cascade. So it halts the inverse cascade, this friction term. You don't have to put that in. I just wanted to compare to work that others had done. And this is the slope we get. If you had more range here, and we eventually will have higher resolution runs, this should eventually approach a -3. It's a logarithmically corrected -3 spectrum. This is an inverse cascade. Here we're forcing. So this is the first time I've really obtained a clear signature of an inverse cascade. And this basically shows that spectral reduction can capture both the entropy cascade and the inverse cascade. This only works with uniform bins, though. And that's the catch. The reason I could not get the inverse cascade before was I was using non-uniform bins. In almost all cases, except for once, I think I did do a simulation, but it was very slow. I've now found a faster way to do this. What I haven't explained here is that this run was done with a new pseudo-spectral formulation of spectral reduction. So I call it pseudo-spectral reduction, where I've reduced, I've done the reduction in a DNS. Not in spectral space, but I can actually exploit now for the first time the full advantages of the fast Fourier transform. And yes, I used implicit dealiasing for this. So we're still, this is just a new code we've written in the last week. This idea that was suddenly the realization that we could do pseudo-spectral reduction only came to Malcolm and I here at this meeting in the last couple of weeks. We've almost got it implemented in an efficient way. These are preliminary results from an inefficient implementation, just a proof of principle. And here you see we got the slope, the -5/3 in the inverse cascade very nicely. So we're really happy about that. The trouble is that this only works with uniform bins, and that still seems like a limitation. And Malcolm's work is now to try to get around that problem. So he's going to talk about that next. How do we live with uniform bins? It seems spec reduction only works in that case. Is there something we can do with that restriction? Okay, thank you for your time, and I'll let Malcolm take over from here.
Well, be a second setting up, so if you have any questions.
Unless you want to just do here. But you might have it might be better on yours. Yeah, okay. And you can have the little gadget there. Okay. And you might want the microphone too.
Yeah, it's turning on.
solution.
Yeah. Yeah, second.
Well, maybe there's any disruption right now. Any questions? I'd say we're running this. We've got this pseudo-spectral simulation running, but it was just a proof of principle. It's actually 9 times slower than it should be. And I apologize, just doing the last little bit of coding. We're hoping to have it ready today to show you the fast version, but that's not really important. It's not really important. So with the scaling of n log n rather than n squared. So pseudo-spec reduction used to have a scaling of n squared. And the only reason it was interesting is that my n there was much lower than the usual n, because I reduced the number of wave numbers. So I was willing to live with n squared. But not if I had a uniform binning, because then my bins have to be pretty small, and I need quite a few of them. But now that we have pseudo-spec reduction, which scales like n log n, we can live with a higher n, and I can maybe tolerate a uniform binning. But nevertheless, let's see what we can do to get around the problems, the limitations of uniform binning. So thank you, Malcolm, from before.
Yeah, so this is my PhD work at the University of Alberta, and with John and also Bruno Eckhart in Marburg has been involved with this. Before I started my graduate work, John did a sabbatical there, and you spent a lot of time on this at that time, or earlier, I suppose.
I spent enough time to realize we need to get a clean, nice, clean implementation.
Yeah.
Test these ideas.
Yeah, so two implementations later, we have the multispectral method, which is what I'm going to talk about today. So, the usual introductory slide. So here are the Navier-Stokes equations. We're going to deal with the incompressible case, and we have this lovely Reynolds number, and then we have this dissipation scale, which grows like the 4/3 power of the viscosity. Let me just move the cursor down. So, and then the number of modes grows really quite quickly with the Reynolds number in 3D, and we just can't perform, we have so many modes that we need that we can't perform the simulations that we want to perform. So we need to get around this. I mean, some applications, some ways to get around this are just changing viscosity. So you change physical parameters of the system you want to evolve so that you can fit it on your computer, which is not ideal in, you know, so many ways. So the way we're trying to get around this problem is by using the multispectral method. So John talked about spectral reduction, and this is sort of like multispectral reduction, okay? So spectral reduction is a reduced model. So, and the problem with it is that you need to decimate uniformly, right? So it's a decimation method. High wave number behavior is pretty good, but the low wave number causes problems, right? So you have a lot of, I mean, you're really coarse graining the large scale stuff. If you want to know if your hurricane is going to go here or here, this is a large scale piece of information, and you would like to know it fairly exactly because it has really, there's a lot of energy at the large scales. So, you know, in terms of energy being an important thing, you want to maybe bin when the energy is low so that your bins have approximately in some way, shape, or form similar energies. So, this is the problem we have. So we would like to decimate only at high wave numbers, but we can't do that with spectral reduction. So the solution is that we use more than one grid, okay? So everything in this talk is basically in Fourier space, and it's not, so whenever you see a grid, it's a Fourier space grid. So we put the Fourier origin here, these are two-dimensional grids, and we keep a full DNS here, and then we have below it a subgrid, which reaches higher wave numbers, but is decimated. Okay, so the low wave number, I mean, we can just use a DNS here, right? Like, we don't need to approximate any of the interactions on the grid. Okay, so the grid's always going to be blue. And we have, below that, we have a high wave number decimated grid using some subgrid model, right? So, and since it's decimated uniformly, right? So in this case, we've kicked out, I think, every fourth mode or something like that. We have some choices here, or we've kept one of every 9 modes. Since it's decimated uniformly, we can use spectral reduction here. Okay, so we've got a full DNS grid and a pseudo-spectral reduction subgrid. So now that we have these two grids, we have the DNS, so we have an evolution equation there. We have the subgrid, where we have spectral reduction, so we have an evolution equation there. So we have evolution equations for both grids. We can move them forward in time. The problem is we need to synchronize the two grids.
So this is what we do, okay? So we start with the grid. So we have the grid, we move it forwards in time using its evolution equation and some conventional integrator we're using Runge-Kutta's. Now we have a new state. So we need to project that state onto the subgrid, and then we move the subgrid forward in time, and the subgrid has a new state. So we need to prolong those changes back up to the grid. Okay, so this is the grid. Think of it as having lots of modes. This is the subgrid. Think of it as having lots of modes too. Okay, so the first thing we do is we move the grid forward in time. Then we project down onto the subgrid. Then we move the subgrid forward in time, and then we prolong back up onto the grid. This is one choice. There's two choices for how we keep the grids in sync. But this is the, you know, as a test code, you know, as a work in progress, this is sort of similar to work out and program. So this is the basic step, and you can keep doing this step where you move forward, project, move forward, and prolong. Okay, and this is a complete, you know, this shows two complete time steps for this method. And you can apply like a, you know, a dynamic time stepping and all these sorts of things to this. So, in my master's, I applied this to shell models of turbulence. So shell models of turbulence are nice because they're simple, the geometry is simple, they're one-dimensional, though they try and mimic two- or three-dimensional turbulence, and they're really fast, right? So, and it worked really well. You also have some nice things, like if you take the GOI model and you spectrally reduce it, it becomes the DN model, which is another well-known shell model, and then that's a stable point. So if you spectrally reduce the DN model, it again is the DN model. And you can see that here you have, this is the grid, and then you have a change in resolution here, and this is the subgrid, okay? And there's really, I mean, like, there's no appreciable change over the interface between the two grids. So it works really well with the shell model of turbulence, which was really nice to see. And we learned a lot by applying this to shell models. So I think they're really nice test beds. So now we want to apply this to Navier-Stokes turbulence. So this is my PhD work. And two dimensions seems like a good place to start because it's less than three. And we're going to deal with the vorticity formulation, so just notation here, and then when I do not bold the omega, that means it's just the component in the z direction, so it can be plus or minus. So here's the evolution equation. I just wanted to put this on the screen so I could refer to it later. We also, in some cases, have to deal with this q squared a bit, and we have this interaction coefficient here. In 2D, we have these 2D grids. With a 1D shell model, your decimation choice was pretty clear. With 2D, it gets a bit more complicated. We have choices once we decimate, so we have to decimate the subgrid in a variety of fashions. You know, we have some choice there. And then once we have a choice of decimation, then we have a choice of synchronization. So here's a couple of things we need. We need a square lattice. We need to conserve energy and entropy when we synchronize the grids, right? Synchronizing shouldn't inject or remove energy or entropy. It needs to be local in Fourier space because we want this to sort of represent the same state. And we also want this to be, you know, I mean, as your time step goes to zero and the evolution equations change the grid and the subgrid less and less, the synchronization shouldn't change it unduly. For example, this is a radix 2 type of grid, and that by radix 2 basically I mean that you've changed the mode spacing in the subgrid, which is blue here, by a factor of 2. So this is sort of moving in a checkerboard pattern, okay? It's rad 2 in each direction, it's rad root 2 in each direction, so the sort of mode density decreases by a factor of 2, because you're in two dimensions. With this, basically, the only way we can meet all of the things, all of the synchronization operators, the projection and prolongation operators, have to only deal with the coincident modes, right? So here we have a blue mode on the subgrid, and it's right over top a black mode on the grid, right? So for this particular decimation, we can only synchronize these coincident modes. We also have a radix 2 grid, right? So here we keep only one of every four modes on the subgrid, okay? And again, we have coincident modes, and the only way to meet all the criteria we want for the synchronization is to deal with only coincident modes. So again, just coincident modes. We just copy state from one grid to another. Here's a Radix 9, or Radix 3, and in two dimensions I call it Radix 9, where, I mean, really it becomes a fair bit sparser. Here's the grid, and we have two choices here, which is kind of nice, and I can go into the details of that. Well, I will go into the details of that a little bit later. But there are two projection and prolongation choices. So either you again just deal with the coincident modes, or, and this ties in with spectral reduction, you can bin things. So we can synchronize 9 modes on the grid. So you basically have, like, around this mode, there's this whole box which contains 9 modes, right? And this one is going to be 9 modes around that one. So we can synchronize in some averaging operation, which is what spectral reduction does. So coincident mode synchronization, so the first synchronization choice, which works on the root 2, 2, and 3 radix grids, it's still hard to program, but it's not as hard as the other way. So this is your definition of energy, or entropy rather. So you have all the modes on the grid, which are not coincident, and then all the modes on the grid, and all the modes on the subgrid, which are not coincident, right? Now you don't have this binning factor here, because this is sort of the this point, coincident projection is sort of the same thing as just kicking out modes, okay? And we'll see how that ends up being a problem. So, and we have also energy conserved. So, and there's two tests basically that we perform. So we want to reproduce the equipartition spectrum, and we can do that really well. Here's the theoretical prediction, and then, you know, the red line is the actual computed value. I should mention also that I guess it's typical to sort of bin spectra, but because I really wanted to see what was going on, I figure out all the unique radii that are achieved by modes on the grid, and then I plot it at all those points, right? So, like, I achieve this radius, I achieve this radius, and then the number of radii grows really quickly. It seems to grow like n to the power 1.7, which I can't quite figure out why. I've asked Terry Gannon about this number theorist in the department, if he knows anything about it.
Beta function that describes it. You know,
yeah, he didn't.
Radii you achieve on lattice.
Well, I asked him the question, and he said he was going to work on it for me, so, you know, yeah. So Radix 2, I mean, all of these grids with the coincident projection work really well. So, yeah. So a bit more of a problem comes in when we try to force dissipate of turbulence. So when we add a forcing term and a viscous term, then, so here's... blue is our control run, so this is a 127 squared, fully dealiased, using the implicit method, simulation in blue. And you can see also when it gets down to the really small scales, past, like in the corners, past the circular core, I mean, the spectrum's not very good there. This is the Radix root 2 scheme, and you can sort of see, here's the grid boundary, and you can actually see it, unfortunately. And what seems to be happening is that there's the slight bottleneck increase, right? Because if you have, try and draw this where everyone can see it. So here's your grid, and I'll just draw the upper half plane, and here's your subgrid. Like these modes here would normally be able to send some energy to higher wave numbers. But we've removed this interaction, and we've only kept the interactions where, like, so these X's are subgrid modes. The subgrid modes are here, so we can send energy there, but we're missing these interactions, which would normally, say, send some energy there, but since we don't have a mode there, we have a bit of a bottleneck. This bottleneck isn't that bad with Radix root 2, but if you go to Radix root Radix 2, you have a bit more of a bottleneck. And if you go to Radix 9, then, I mean, like, it builds up here, and the energy really doesn't get transferred to the small scales on the subgrid. So, but that's not that unexpected, because we've just removed these modes, and we've shown that just decimating the nonlinearity and not dealing with it in any other way isn't really all that effective. So we get this bottleneck. So one thing we can do, and this is sort of, I mean, this is not even a poor man's renormalization, this is a beggar's renormalization, okay? So we've kicked out, you know, we've kept one for every 9 modes, so we can try just, you know, depending on the radix. So in the radix root 2, we keep half the modes, in the radix 2, we keep a fourth of the modes, in the radix 3, we keep a ninth of the modes. So we can just try rescaling the nonlinearity to try and, you know, keep, you know, if we have half the modes now, we should multiply by 2 to try and, you know, say that, well, you know, we'll try and at least scale up the nonlinearity to accommodate for the fact that we've decreased the number of interactions.
This is just an interim solution.
Yeah.
I get my code ready for him to hook up to.
Yeah.
It will be much better than that.
Yeah. But even though, I mean, it sort of gives you some idea that this might actually work, because though you have a little bit of a bottleneck, it's really going to agree on the small scales a lot better. Like, here's the bottleneck, but you sort of get something pretty close to the same slope. And then this was, this was really bad before, and it's still kind of bumpy, and there's still a bit of a bottleneck, but I mean, you're getting basically the same slope in the very small scales. So that is the coincident projection, right? The coincident projection, which is basically kicking out modes, works on all of the grid decimations I've shown. Okay, and we have these results. There's still some bottleneck, and we're hoping to improve this by working with the average projection. So coupling more modes should help remove this bottleneck. So what we're going to do, and this just works on the radix 3 grid, where we keep one of every 9 modes, we're going to synchronize all of these 9 modes on the grid with this one mode on the subgrid. So here's the projection operator, okay? So it's sort of weighted by the entropy. And we have a similar prolongation operator, which is similarly weighted. And then this is the choice of projection and prolongation, which allows you to conserve energy and entropy by using a weighted average of the grid modes on the subgrid. So, and we also, when we have our, we conserve entropy, and that entropy has this bin, the bin size in it, right? So the size of the bin is 9 modes in one subgrid mode. So that's nice that we keep that there. And similarly, it conserves energy with a correct factor in there. So this is sort of a more physical energy and entropy than just kicking out modes. And again, if we just decimate the nonlinearity and pretend that we haven't kicked out any modes when in fact we have, we get something similar happening here, where the energy is just not effectively transferred to the small scales. But if you rescale the nonlinearity by inversing the number of modes that you've kicked out, then you end up getting the same slope. This is still not really perfect or what we want, but this is incomplete work, and the next step is going to be to add the pseudospectral reduction, which is new as of last week. And we're hoping that this will take care of, I mean, we get the slope here, but maybe it'll move it up and get rid of that bottleneck, just by the fact that it, you know, it takes into effect the fact that these bins represent more than just one mode. They represent 9 modes. So when we put that into the code, we're hoping that that'll work out.
We think the spec reduction is a much better subgrid model than anything else that's been tried. In fact, it's so good that I showed you results of using it as a full simulation.
Yeah.
The only problem is the binning has to be uniform. So here, if we could use it as a subgrid model, it'd be wonderful. And I hope next week, I'm giving a talk next week on Wednesday. Maybe we'll have a slide ready for you that I can put in there.
I have to leave tomorrow, but yeah. I also, just before this talk, I was talking with CK, and so you tried doing something sort of similar to this, where you basically, I think this is very similar to decimated DNS, I might be able to grab a simulation. But the other, one of the test things that we did when developing this code is you can take just a basic DNS simulation and so here's your origin, and you have, let's keep that many. So if you keep this as your grid, but you have this all, okay, well, normally you would have like a lot of modes going out to with the same spacing, right? So I think what you did, CK, can you see this? Is that you basically just removed this, this, and this from the system. Is that effectively what you did?
So I actually would say what I did was the model I wanted to describe in your talk. It's pretty much the same except the nonlinear term. So when So I actually have many layers of the grid itself too.
Yeah.
And the motivation is I want to do like we know some attention.
Yeah, so that's our goal too. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So and the way I do that is when I have two levels of the grid, my computation is actually in a domain that cover fully both of them.
Yeah, at full resolution.
This is your two level of grid. So this one has high resolution, this one is lower, even in the case space.
Yeah.
So what I do is when I do the nonlinear interaction, I actually have a domain that is full of everything. So you fully cover the two levels. But after I've done the nonlinear interaction, I just project it back to the two different levels. So I'm actually dropping modes in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. See, the thing is, like this seems like decimated DNS. So I was thinking actually after I spoke with you, is that we tried doing this and I got a huge bottleneck.
Right.
Yeah. And I can.
You said you, at the small scales, you keep all the modes or you throw out modes?
So this is, so I'm talking about two level interaction.
Yeah, right.
So when I do the nonlinear interaction,
yes.
I make sure I have high enough resolution so I fully cover both of them.
And it's a uniform grid. Yeah, I'm only interested in how we do the nonlinear term right now.
Yeah, so.
And
so say in your. Okay, so say you did. I gave you in 3D.
The grids you've drawn there look like they have the same resolution, so the same spacing. That's what maybe can you.
So let's see what
better picture.
So say your number of grid points n square.
Yeah.
And your delta k, I just call it delta k. So that's one grid.
Yeah.
And for the high resolution grid, your n square, your delta k becomes delta k over u. Right. So when I do the nonlinear interaction, I have a grid that's 2n square, and I have delta k over u. So I do all the nonlinear interaction here. And then project it back to these
yeah.
levels.
Yeah. Did you get it to work?
So I think for 3D it actually works for this. For high 3D hydro, I don't think I see such a bad model that so I thought it works. But
yeah.
when I trying to do something with MHD, then I got strange thing and then I give up.
Yeah.
I don't think it matters for whether it's 2D or 3D. So we should talk after about exactly what projection and prolongation you use.
Well, it wasn't projection and prolongation. It was just like it was. I think it was just like you can equivalently do this by.
I'm just dropping modes.
You are dropping.
You're just dropping modes.
Right.
Yeah. So you just drop modes, but this is a Radix 2 simulation, and normally it should be going down like here, and then we have this bottleneck here. And it's actually really, another choice, and I also am sort of thinking about this circular option, right? So
you drop modes here, right?
But if you, this one, yeah, this is dropping modes. This is just dropping modes. So basically what you can do is, you just basically work on a restricted Fourier basis, right? So if you start with, if you initialize your system, so that some modes are zero, or like if you can choose an arbitrary mode in your system and set it to zero at the beginning, right? Now, if the system there's this detailed conservation of energy and entropy, right? So each triadic interaction will conserve energy and entropy. So basically, by removing one mode from your system, you've removed a bunch of these triadic interactions, right? So it should still conserve energy and entropy. Now, the convolution will try and put stuff there, so you have to zero it out at each time step. In order to conserve energy and entropy, right? This is your sampling thing, right? You have to remove that from the output of your nonlinear source calculation. And you can do that, right? So what I did in this plot is that right about here, I removed 3 of every 4 modes, right? And I get this, I mean, I clearly get a bottleneck, and it's pretty bad.
It's very simple to do. You just did a full DNS, and you zeroed some stuff out.
Did a full DNS, zeroed some stuff out. Yeah.
So this didn't work.
And I also tried it with like a circular boundary, thinking that maybe it was the corners of the grid which were the problem. But this actually ends up being much worse, because in this code, in that simulation, you had sort of the bottleneck smoothed out by the fact that you had these triangles. Okay, well, it's a bit hard to see, but
asymptote here that's running.
Yeah.
Asymptote is the graphics program.
So, but yeah, it ended up like that didn't get rid of the bottleneck either. So.
I'd like to see the results.
Yeah.
I'd like to see the results. Do you still have them?
So I don't have them on my laptop, but when I go back to stock up, I can find them.
Sure, that would be very good. Yeah, we can talk by email.
Yeah. But yeah, you have a question, or are you just stretching?
In general basis, when you do RGD simulation, usually filtering takes out a lot of energy. Most of simulation, you lose, to respect to a DNS, 40% of your energy.
Yeah.
So in this case, you don't have use any rescaling of the global energy on the spectra. So all the mods that you solved keep the same energy they would have been in the previous.
Yes.
We don't have a filter here at all. There's no subgrid filter. In fact, we're trying to develop a subgrid model.
Yeah, it's a new way. A new way.
But yeah, I mean,
you have less mod anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the point.
The same energy.
Yeah. But the other nice thing.
The residual mods that you pick should have more energy.
Which is this factor of 9.
I don't have more energy, or you think of them as intensities, and then you scale them by an area that they're representing. So what I call big omega, that was kind of like an average, typical characteristic mode in the bin, but it represented many modes. So either you can do it either way. You can think of one big mode with all the energy in it, or one mode that represents all of its neighbors. Yeah. Represented a proxy mode.
But at any rate, the definition of energy, which is the energy which is conserved, is a physical energy. I mean, it's coarse grained a little bit, but it still has the same magnitude.
And do you think it can be used to match different kind of numerical methods when you have a multi-domain decomposition, a complex flow? And for instance, you would use DNS in certain parts.
You should be able to. I think there is some way. Yeah. Yeah. So basically, the subgrid has to be as long as you can project to Fourier space from your DNS. You have to be able to project to Fourier space because you need to do the projection, the synchronization in Fourier space. But your subgrid could be. No. Your grid could be a finite difference code. Your subgrid has to be a spectral code. And in terms of also applying this to, there's also the fictitious domain penalty method type of technique, which you can just impose some boundary conditions into a spectral simulation. So this might be a way to deal with that. I haven't been dealing specifically with boundary conditions yet, for various obvious reasons. That.
Actually, can I say something?
Yeah.
So when I did whatever I am in the doing MHD and it didn't work. So the way I convince myself is, in MHD, you are not really homogeneous at a small scale. But when I'm dropping more, I'm actually saying difference should be homogeneous. So if you have that basic in mind, then I don't really know if you can do your spectral reduction in complex geology.
Yeah.
Things are not homogeneous anymore.
Yeah, I know. But the question is whether it may not reproduce the instantaneous state of the full system, but it may still, like the hope is then, is that you can still get the average state of the system. But yeah, so, we certainly have to do an approximation. So the question is where we put the damage. Yeah.
For instance, I'm thinking of a possible application that looks to me very interesting. Boundary layer or channel flows.
Yeah.
The LES model is wrong close to the wall.
Yeah.
It's wrong.
Yeah.
There are nothing to do, conceptually wrong. So it would be nice to do the viscous layer with ENS.
Yeah.
So you solve well the physics. And then to start using more distance from the wall and LES, where it is more true than the small scale are kind of symmetric and so on.
Yeah.
And this would be.
Yeah, if we can get this, we're hoping like once we get the pseudospectral reduction implemented as a subgrid, then we certainly going to look at things like this. Yeah.
Maybe not spectral across the wall, then normal across the wall.
Yeah.
Not Fourier spectral, but you can use other kind of spectral method.
I want to emphasize why we use the term prolong and project. These are multi-grid terms. But we're not doing multi-grid in X space. Here we're doing multi-grid in wave number space. So that's kind of what we're trying to develop. And the reason we do the projection prolongation in wave number space is we're, in 2D, we're very concerned about both energy and density conservation. And it's much harder to do that in X space. In Fourier space, everything, these are just algebraic relationships. So it's rather straightforward getting energy and density conserved if you pick the right projection prolongation operators. Now, one other thing we want to talk about, we still have this, partly because I don't have a lot of ideas on this idea, but going back to the pseudospectral method itself, and how do we parallelize it on massively parallel machines? I don't know if anybody has some ideas. Maybe we can talk informally about it. My understanding is that 1D transforms parallelize quite well on massively parallel machines. So I don't know to what extent that's really true. But I've heard this said, and I haven't looked into it myself. But using domain decomposition, that surprised me a little bit because even in 1D, the FFT is the Fourier transform is very non-local, and so you still must have massive communication costs. So, however, I do know that we could do the 1D FFT on the graphics process in the departments. GPU is very, very effective. The problem is with 2D and 3D, we just have too much data for a single GPU to start communicating. And the big problem is this transpose you have to do. So I wonder, instead of doing the usual thing when we write a 2D FFT, we often transpose in X, and then, Fourier transform in X, and then we do a transpose, and then we Fourier transform in Y. Maybe what we should be doing is Fourier transforming in blocks, local blocks, square blocks, not columns and rows. And I believe some of the effective methods for doing 2D Fourier transforms do that anyway, like FFTW. Yeah. I believe they try to exploit data locality and work in blocks. We still have communication costs, though, and so I don't know whether it can be done that way. But maybe this is what we have to do, is not think in terms of rows and columns, but think in terms of blocks. Certainly, when I did the aliasing, I found it was effective to reduce a 3D convolution to a 2D convolution and then to a 1D. And maybe there's other ways, other decompositions that are more effective than this simple-minded approach. Okay. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have some ideas about how to do this, but they're pretty half-baked, and I haven't been able to spend a lot of time on them, so.
Thinking that might be a good postdoc project for you.
Yeah, I would love to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So thanks for your time, everyone. And I guess we have like just a couple minutes for the next talk.
Okay.